Welcome to another edition of Adam Shand at Large. I've got a series of unresolved stories I've worked on over the past 20 years that I'll never let go. High on that list is the 1969 murder of 20-year-old Lucille Gay Butterworth. The Tasmanian coroner has found that a man named Geoffrey Charles Hunt picked her up from a bus stop in Hobart on August 25th, 1969. She was travelling to New Norfolk outside Hobart to attend a meeting about the Miss Tasmania pageant, and then she was going to meet her boyfriend, John Fitzgerald. She never arrived. The coroner found that Hunt knew Lucille because he once worked at John Fitzgerald's family store in New Norfolk. She took the offer of a ride from Hunt, who on the road to New Norfolk tried to initiate sex with her. When she struggled, Hunt strangled her and disposed of her body in or near the Derwent River. How do we know all this? Well, Hunt has confessed on several occasions to this. To police in 1976, when he was arrested for another murder, that of Susan Knight, but the police didn't believe him. He's also confessed to fellow cellmates, and who knows else. And he's still free today after serving a life sentence for Susan Knight's murder. The pain for Lucille's family is unending. Of her direct family, only one member remains. Her parents died long ago, and her half-brother, Jimmy, passed in 2019. Only younger brother John remains, and he's my guest today. G'day, John.
Hi, Adam. How are you?
Good, mate. We've been talking about this story for a long time, 5 years or more now, and I wonder what it's like for you as you see your family gradually pass on, as we all have to cope with in our human existence, but to not have the answer and see your parents go to their grave, see your half-brother Jimmy go to his grave. It is just you left. How does that feel?
I promised Mum that, we would find out, or find her remains, promised Dad the same thing. And so it is difficult because, as you said, I'm the only one left. And I'm hoping that I can hang around for a few more years. And maybe something might turn up, knowing where she might be is even more difficult, because as you probably know, I've dived in the Derwent looking, I've dug holes all over the place in the area where allegedly she's supposed to be, or was supposed to have been, for want of a better word, dumped by Geoffrey Charles Hunt. But, it hasn't revealed anything as of yet.
Yeah. But no love could be greater than yours for Lucille. I mean, you talk about digging holes and diving, and I'm aware of that. You went down there when there was nothing happening in the case, when all leads were exhausted, when the DPP had said, we will not prosecute Mr. Hunt, for want of, I'm not sure what was lacking in that case, but you took things into your own hands and you kept the case in the media. You went down there and you literally dug holes on the bank of the Derwent. You went and dived in that murky water. And I mean, I guess it's just for want of something better to do.
Yes. I'd do it again too. Wouldn't worry me. If only he'd leave a note or something like that, saying this is where she is.
That is the thing. And Geoffrey Charles Hunt, he's living in a Tasmanian town we can't name. He lives an absolutely awful existence. He rarely goes out of his house. And I know that because I staked his house out a few years ago. I spent the night in the freezing rain there. And the only way I knew he was inside was that the heating pipe of his house was warm, indicating someone was inside. All the lights were off. He lives a life where he sees nobody. The next day, I followed him. Sounds like a secret agent or a stalker or something, but I think it was worthwhile. I followed him all the way to his parole hearing at another town. And when he came out, he had to walk about 2 kilometres between where he was to where he caught his bus back to his house. And he went about a 3-kilometre winding journey through the back streets, looking over his shoulder and trying to work out. And I'm too good. He would never have seen me. And also the fact that he is albino, as several members of his family were, and his sight is not great. Anyway, so he's winding his way there. And I thought to myself, I could rush up and kind of ask him questions and things like that. And say, did you kill Lucille? As other journalists said, he would just say no and tell me to piss off. But I thought, let me watch this bloke and understand his life. This is no life. I mean, if he's listening, which I doubt, you know, Mr. Hunt, come on, put this whole family out of their misery. At least tell us where Lucille is. And particularly, John, you're a very important part of this chain, because if remains are found, it's your DNA they'll be matching it to.
That's right. Yeah, they've had the police forensic laboratory has had my blood or DNA for years, so that if anything ever turns up, which it would only be bone, I guess, which, you know, we had a little rumour that, or hearsay that I had heard about not so long ago, where they've started the construction of the Bridgewater Bridge, the new one, and there were apparently some bones that were revealed or dug up. But I think they might have been Aboriginal or Middens or something like that. And so I had a conversation with an inspector out at Glenorchy Police Station, and he assured me that that's what it was.
So you know the river. You know the river well.
Yep.
It is a fast-flowing river. Back in years past, I've been told that it was, if the tide's running the right way, outwards in other words, she might not have remained near the bank. She might have been far away by the following day. What's your understanding of the currents there?
As far as her going any further, no. I mean, if someone, you know, jumped off the Tassie Bridge, then they could very well end up out in Storm Bay. Absolutely. You know, the current runs through there at probably more than 7 knots. It is fairly fast, and for a diver, that's out of the question completely. You know, over 2 knots, and you know, you're struggling with fins on.
So, John, what you're saying is you think her body could still be somewhere in the Derwent, in marshland, not too far from where she was supposedly disposed of.
Even back in, let's just say 70, in 1970, that area, he could have possibly driven off. It was a little parking spot. There were two parking spots there that were quite regularly used by lovers, if you like. And he could have possibly driven around, heading up to New Norfolk, turned right into the into that little car park area where they dug in 2014, and driven his car slightly round to the right further, and he would have been out of sight. There is a creek that runs through there. There's a creek that runs through parallel with Norfolk Road, and then it veers off northwest, and goes out into the Derwent. But it's, Adam, it's a fair way away. There's no way he could have trundled through, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 metres of marshland to actually lay her in the Derwent proper. No, not my opinion anyway.
Well, because when we do have the parallel, the precedent of what happened with Susan Knight, in that case, a very similar murder, and he then just covered her body with sticks and brush, a very, very cursory. So, like I say, the idea, though, that the river is fast flowing or the tide comes in and takes her away. But I guess bottom line is, do you think there's still any purpose in police continuing to search there or mount a new search? Because back when David Plumpton and Carrie Milhouse had the case back in the mid-2015 and so, they did do a ground penetrating radar. They've had a good look. They found nothing. Do you think it's still worth going back there?
Yes. I think it's worth digging probably about 40 metres further out from where they dug, in the first place. And I think if you were to speak to Carey Milhouse, he would agree on that. I don't think they went out far enough. They would have had their reasons for that, I guess. And they're the ones that, you know, are digging with the excavators and that.
And you're right, Carey Milhouse, who was on the investigation, he's now out of the force, and he actually exactly said that. His advice is it should have gone further. But you see, my problem with ground-penetrating radar is I've never seen it come up with anything. It's a very great technological story and so forth, but I've never seen it work in any particular case. Anybody out there who's had a case that's been solved by ground-penetrating radar, please get in touch, because I just wonder whether it was false hope in the first place.
And in addition to that, they were thinking about ground-penetrating radar through a drone. But, of course, they couldn't do that because of the canopy of trees. And I know what that's like, because you've got to crawl through it, and there are berry bushes and so blackberry bushes. So yeah, it's quite overgrown. So that's why I think that even if it was overgrown back in the 70s, which I would have thought it would be, I can't see how he would have gone any further than his car would have allowed him to go without being bogged.
And I think also what we saw with the Susan Knight murder again was an overwhelming sense of shame. He wanted to get himself away from that scene. His compulsion, his sickness, paraphilia, whatever you want to call it, drove him to this act, and he was full of shame. In fact, we have evidence from his brother on the night that Lucille disappeared. He was in his bed crying inconsolably.
So,
my hope is that he can be prevailed upon to confess one more time.
Yes.
And put your family out of its misery, your misery.
That's right. I agree. I mean, I've been up, as you know, I've been up to his house, knocked on his door, tried to get him to, well, obviously he wouldn't come out. I mean, that's just not idealistic. In his cunning, there's no way he would come out. He was there. He was inside his house.
Yeah, I don't think he goes anywhere. And of course, we had the same scene. Your brother Jimmy, which set off a big alarm. He was driving up there. He had terminal cancer, and he was basically, what we understood was that he was going to do away with Hunt and then do himself away. And David Plumpton had to intervene, and that was averted. But I mean, that's the level of desperation that you get to in this sort of a case, where justice can't be, even when the murderer has confessed, not once, not twice. I found another, in fact, during our investigation, we found another prisoner who talked about a slightly different version, a slightly different spot, but still the same basic story. How many times you got to confess in Tasmania before they book you? I'm not sure.
That's right. That makes me so angry, Adam, to know that, in some instances, you know, you can't argue with your superior, and that's what it was like back in the 70s. I know that because of my apprenticeship. You know, you couldn't argue with the supervisor or the foreman, otherwise you get a smack in the mouth. It's different now. But back then, you know, I've spoken to O'Geary, and yeah, he is.
And Frank, sorry to interrupt. O'Geary was the officer that was there on that night, 1976, when we interviewed Hunt. There was two there, and the superior officer who's supposed to sign off on the confession and whatever happens in the interview basically talked Hunt out of his confession.
That's
and the
right.
reason was that particular officer had a complete firm conviction that another suspect, John Gannon Lonergan, a taxi driver, had been Lucille's murderer. So when Hunt comes up with this confession, he dismisses it. And the guys go back, O'Geary and his partner go back in again and again, and they reinstate the confession. And once again, the superior officer comes in and says, no, he's withdrawn it. So at the end of all this, we have this open secret. And that lasts from 1976 till about 2015. And it's an open secret within Tasmania Police, but no one thought to tell the Butterworth family.
That's right. We knew absolutely nothing. We were kept in the dark, Adam. We probably still are. We didn't even know that this particular superior officer had taken some of the files away and put them in his garage. I mean, why? Why do you do that? Why, if he's confessed, if Geoffrey Charles Hunt had confessed, then why didn't the interrogation register that? I don't understand. I do not understand that. We would have known after, sadly, well, we could have known beforehand, Adam, and Susan Knight may very well have still been alive.
That's a good point. And yeah, there's also the talk about, this is interesting, actually, you raised that, because in the little town of New Norfolk where Hunt lived, his father was an ex-serviceman and he was close to police there, including ex-servicemen who are now police. And the suspicion was that this police officer or others had intervened in the past when young Geoffrey Hunt had got up to some fairly heinous behaviour, approaching sexual assault, stalking and things like that. So again, this could have been stopped at a much earlier date.
That's right. Exactly. That the police out in Glenorchy should have known through the police in New Norfolk about his particular fancies, if you like, if for want of a better word. He has psychopathic tendencies. He's a sexual deviant with psychopathic tendencies. That's how he was classified. They should have known. They should have rang through and said, no, hang on a minute, you know, the Slewsill Butterworth case, they knew about that. We'd gone all the way up there searching. They knew. They should have rung Glenorchy Police and said, I think you should be looking at this particular person, Geoffrey Charles Hunt.
I think there was a clear line of inquiry there that wasn't taken up, and he was never questioned. But I think there was a certain level of protection of young Geoffrey for some time, because in that little town of New Norfolk, being an albino, and he had a couple of sisters and brothers who were also albino, set them apart. They were marginalised, bullied sometimes, and even Lucille. I mean, as we now know, she knew him, and he had peeked at her over the fence while she was sunbaking, and she didn't like him, and she'd said to John Fitzgerald, you know, Whitey's been looking at me, and she even probably called him Whitey to his face, which you know, I think you can see the pathology of a person like that, who he's now. At this time, he was only a young man, wasn't he? How old was he at this time?
He's about 2 or 3 years older than me, so I'm nearly 70, so he'd be 73.
Yeah, but at the time, back in the day, I'm just going to do the math.
Yeah, understand. He probably would have been 18, I guess, 18 or 19.
A young man who had a history of being bullied, sexually rejected,
yep,
mocked even, and he develops a very thick skin, and yes, he has this strong fantasy life, which we see playing out. And you're dead right. That sort of person today would be top of the persons of interest in an
Absolutely.
Investigation like this.
Yes. And once again, he should have been back then.
Let's go right back. August 1969. You're at home. The phone rings. It's news that Lucille's missing. Tell us what happened. You saw this firsthand.
Yes. Well, I picked up the phone. It was her fiancé, John Fitzgerald, to say, was Lucille there, as in, was Lucille at home? I said, no. She's supposed to be with you. And he said, no, she didn't arrive here. So I was getting ready to go to school, so I just said, hang on a minute, I'll get Mum. And Mum come to the phone, and basically the same conversation. Dad was at work, and Mum collapsed on the floor. Well, I grabbed hold of her. She basically collapsed on the floor because we knew straight away. Absolutely straight away, Adam. There's no way that Lucille would have gone. She'd been picked up and missed the bus, and it started from there. We had to get Dad home, Jimmy over from his work. And for about 2 weeks.
Jimmy is your half-brother?
Yes, a half-brother. And, you know, for about 2 weeks, we were the ones that instigated, not me so much, but Dad and Jim and John organised the search parties which everyone got involved in. And I think it was about 2 weeks after that police finally decided that there'd been foul play. That's verbatim. That's exactly what they said to us. Oh, we think there's been foul play.
Well, from earlier, saying, oh, well, she's a flighty young lady. She's probably gone to the mainland with a new boyfriend. Is there problems in her relationship? Victim blaming. I mean, that's almost misogynism to me. And those vital hours, those vital days where there could have been searches, there could have been chats to persons of interest, hello, like Mr. Hunt, all that time was lost.
That's right. Now, if we'd have known anything about Geoffrey Charles Hunt at that time, because I travelled when I got my licence every now and then with a friend, a colleague of my, or a friend of mine, I used to travel up to New Norfolk on the old road. So the old road used to go round past the lime kiln, not like it does now. And you know, Adam, that was one of the reasons why Mum and Dad were very sceptical about Lucille taking her Austin A40, Rupert, as she called it, on that road, because it's not the road that people would drive on today. It was completely different. It had hollows in it because of the River Derwent, and, you know, seepages and that sort of thing. And Mum and Dad were just very, very dubious about her taking a car up there. Jim had a little bit of a different perspective. He probably thought that maybe she would have been okay. Me, well, being a 15, you know, nearly 16-year-old, and I'd sat in the car when Lucille went missing, and, you know, just started it up and drove it up and down the laneway. Yeah, probably would have made it, Adam. But they're the things that we didn't know. We didn't know anything about Geoffrey Charles Hunt.
She was doing something that so many people had done, just caught a bus from Hobart to New Norfolk. There should not have been any concern about her. And this is the problem with these terrible outcomes. People are left with their sense of guilt, your parents not letting her take Rupert, the woman who drove her to the bus stop, John Fitzgerald, who might have come and got her. Everyone's got some element, this terrible legacy they carry with them. And this destroys families. It really does. I've seen this. We did a few weeks ago, we did a chat with Ricky Nash, who's the brother of Cheryl Grimmer, who disappeared in 1970 off Ferry Meadow Beach near Wollongong. And he was there with his siblings looking after her. And he went down to the beach for a few minutes, leaving her in the shower block, and she was taken by a monster. And now, just like you, for 5 decades, he's had this guilt. What's it like? We could never understand, but it hollows out families. And I've seen the dramas in your family. I've unfortunately sparked a couple by talking about them. But what's it done to your family?
Well, Jim's not here now, of course, and can't speak ill.
I miss him.
But, yeah, it's Mum and Dad that I was more keen and interested in trying to keep alive. I live with them both. I watched them slowly disintegrate. They wanted to – I had the opinion, which I could be wrong about, but I had the opinion that they felt that they didn't necessarily want to be around anymore. The same questions would come up, you know, why weren't we told? Why was Lonigan the only one, you know, that was in the frame? Why did those superior officers end up in Sydney chasing him? And, you know, they kept their eye on Lonigan for a long, long time. They knew he was in New Guinea. They knew he was in Bundaberg. He died in Bundaberg from cirrhosis of the liver because he was an alcoholic. But Hunt just didn't come up. It didn't come into the equation at all.
I even interviewed Lonigan's daughter, and she was convinced that he had killed Lucille. Further to that, but you did have a chance to see Hunt in action. He gave evidence at the coronial inquiry. What was it like looking at the person who murdered your sister?
Um, Like, no, just got to grind your teeth. And that's all I did. I just stared at him. He refused to look at the picture of Lucille. So he was facing the coroner, and the picture was on his right-hand side. And he was prompted on a number of occasions to look at the picture. Look at the picture of Lucille, and he wouldn't. That made me angry. We couldn't get anywhere near him when he stepped down and was escorted out the door. You couldn't get anywhere near him. He had security guards around him, police. Yeah.
Well, thank goodness for that.
Yeah, thank goodness for that. No, I don't think that's right, Adam. I think that I would prefer right now that he be alive, because if he passes away, or if he stepped out in front of a bus or whatever, then we're never going to know. You know, one day he could very well have an epiphany and say, I'm going to leave a note, leave it with one of the brothers or the sister, and we could at least find out, maybe. Or is it just rose-coloured glasses, Adam? I don't know. I seriously don't know.
I think most people, when they near their end, like to make amends for things. They have conversations, they do certain things, and you would hope that Hunt feels the same way. Now, dare I say it, I see him as a victim in this process as well. That sounds funny, I know. But if police had taken seriously his confession in 1976 about Lucille, he would have been charged with both those murders. He would have served the life sentences concurrently, and he would have paid his debt to society. Where he finds himself now is he's done one life sentence. He's now on lifetime parole in Tasmania. At one time, he was eligible for parole, and he was apparently planning to move to the mainland, get a caravan and drive around. I mean, how diabolical. When he was released from prison, he was seen lurking around the shower block, toilet block of a local caravan park, and there was great concern. There was reports, and his parole was temporarily revoked. So this is a lifelong thing. But as I say, if he had his confession had been taken seriously, he'd be through the system. He'd be now able to make amends with society. Your family would be in a different state, no doubt. So he has no incentive now. That's the problem. If there was a nice prison farm he could be sent to, he loves dogs and sheep and things, and if he could be sent to a prison farm like he was previously when he did his sentence for Susan Knight, he could live out his days there and contemplate his heinous acts. But at least society and your family would have some kind of justice, if not closure. And closure, by the way, I hate this word closure. I want to ban it from all my interviews because I don't think it exists. You know, how's there ever been closure for your family?
No, there hasn't. There hasn't.
Even the coroner's finding provided no solace at all.
No, it didn't, apart from the fact that, you know, Christine Rushton and the rest of them had agreed that it definitely was him. Well, Christine was absolutely adamant.
And Christine Rushton was the analyst. Christine Rushton was the analyst. For Tasmania Police, who looked at everything, did a fantastic job. In fact, they've got to be singled. Yes. She never gets any praise, by the way, if she's listening, because she did a fantastic job collating everything that David and Carrie did.
Yes. Yes, she did. Even right up until the last investigation that was a guy had come back to Tasmania after 40 years and he'd said that, you know, he was down in an area in Ewerville or somewhere like that where he'd overheard a fat one saying to a skinny one, oh, you know, what have you done with the body? Or they were working on a dairy farm or something like that. Well, I mean, she looked into that and nothing ever, as far as we know, nothing's ever come of that.
Well, but I think that conversation took place, and just to give some detail here, that was Hunt was working on a farm, and this young man, I think, was in stealing eggs or milk or something, and he heard this conversation where Hunt, as you say, was talking about the body and what to do with it and what happened to it and things. But you think, why did you wait so long? And, you know, that's the thing. There's people in Tasmania or elsewhere who know what happened and they haven't come forward. What's in their minds? What are they waiting for? Why are they afraid of Geoffrey Charles Hunt? He's a pathetic individual who actually would be better off in jail.
Yes, that's right. I couldn't agree more. I have no idea.
But you know what makes me really sad? Johnny, sorry to interrupt. You know what makes me really sad about this? I've been on this case for about 5 years now, and I met Jimmy, your brother, and yourself. And you've had dramas over the years because of this. But when I knew you, but I love you both, right? And I could see you were both working for the same outcome. But the damage and the distance this sort of stuff creates between families, it's not your fault at all. And I feel sick about the way that it transpired between you and Jimmy and your families. And I just hope that even if you can't get a result, that you can at least come to some understanding of each other's position. Jimmy's gone now. It's very sad.
Yes.
But that to me was the hardest part.
Well, it's very hard for me, especially when, you know, someone says to your face, you realise Lucille hated your guts. I mean, that was shoveled down my face that many times. I basically got fed up with it. And that was one of the reasons why I just didn't want anything to do with him.
I remember your famous comment when he put the memorial down there in town in Claremont, isn't it, I think? And he put the memorial there, and I told you about it. You said, I want to tie a chain to it and drag it into the street. And I thought, wow. That's some deep rift there.
Yeah, that's right, because it was an insult to, as far as I'm concerned, it was an insult to Mum, because Mum instigated the memorial that we have out there, which is the seat and a white magnolia tree, which is what Mum wanted in 1999. And that's what we did, along with the help from the Glenorchy City Council. Now, that other memorial, Jim decided to put up, it's all about him, is an insult to Mum. That was the absolute finish of it with me. I can't forgive him for that.
Yeah, and this is what happens. I mean, you're both men full of integrity, full of effort, endeavour on behalf of your sister, and that's what counts.
Yes.
But listen, so what? Where from here? You are the last one, Johnny. John Fitzgerald has also passed away.
Yes.
What happens now? What happens when you eventually go? Do you think? I mean, I hope this doesn't happen, but I wonder whether, when there ceases to be someone pushing, talking to journalists, calling the police, it just does end up in oblivion.
I'm not sure. Michelle might. That's my niece from Jim's first marriage. Michelle's quite adamant, you know. She knew Lucille quite well, because I have pictures of Michelle sitting on Lucille's knee. And she has an interest. She goes out to the memorial every now and then.
You are leading the family now. I always remember something you told me in one of our first meetings about the moment where your mum and dad knew, particularly your dad, knew that she was gone. There was an experience that he had.
Yes. Our mum and dad's bedroom looked out over the Tassie Bridge. So basically it looked west. They had two windows. One looked due west and one looked slightly northwest. And Dad woke up one night and there was he described a greeny, reddy, white halo, which was facing the window that faced west, in other words, faced towards Mount Wellington, the Derwent, the Tasman Bridge and Mount Wellington. And he knew then that Lucille had been or wasn't with us. we could say she's been murdered. And, you know, Adam, the things that when I was doing my apprenticeship as a 19, 20-year-old, and having to help, sometimes I helped Dad because he was an engineer, so I'd go up into his engineering shop in the garage and help him out. And, you know, to have my dad turn around and look at me, he had tears in his eyes, and to say to me that it was his fault, his words were, "Son, I blame myself for what's happened to Lucille." And for me to have to stand there and, "Hey, Dad, it wasn't your fault. You can't blame yourself. You know, this is what happened to him, Adam. This is what killed Dad. It was that moment, you know, that I just knew. It was bad enough for Mum, you know, but as I mentioned just a little earlier on, she had a distraction, which was the family as it was, as it stood. Whereas, you know, I'd gone away a couple of times to Sydney, not for very long, but I felt that I had to get out and do something. But that's what killed Dad, for sure. I've got a daughter. I've got Kate here, sitting in her house. I could never, ever contemplate. Now, I ring her every day. She's an intensive care paramedic for the Queensland Ambulance Service. I ring her every day to make sure, because she's been kicked and punched. When she was in Canberra as an intensive care paramedic, she was kicked and punched. I can't handle that, Adam. She's my daughter.
No, you know, and you know, I've got a daughter. She's 26 now, and we have each other on our Find My iPhone. So I know where she is at all times, and she knows where I am at all times. Yeah. So I can't play up, because you know that I wouldn't be where I should be. And that gives us some sort of solace. But back in the day, there was none of that. And we lived outward bound lives. We were innocent. I mean, I was only seven at the time, but in the 70s, we used to go around and, you know, you wouldn't see Mum and Dad all day, but they knew you were safe. But there were monsters. There were monsters lurking. There are many more monsters today, unfortunately. But let's hope that somebody out there can put this to rest finally. I mean, what do you still have hope, John?
Yes,
I wouldn't blame you if you didn't.
No. I'll keep going. If you said to me tomorrow, "I want you down in the Derwent River because I've just found out this, this, and this," I'll be on the next aeroplane. I'll never give up, Adam. I'll never give up. She was my sister. I've got a photograph of her sitting on the wall. I talk to her. I tell her about our grandchildren, and I give her a kiss at night. And say goodnight to her, and I say, "I will find you. I will find your remains so I can put you to rest. One day I will find your remains. They might be small, might only be a little bit, but I'll find them."
All right, John. Well, listen, let me assure you that I will continue on this case as long as I've got breath in me, as long as I continue to work, because these are the ones that need to be solved. These ones help the health of our community, help the trust in our institutions, and keep love alive. So, John Butterworth, thank you so much for sharing this story with me again, and this won't be the last time.
Can I just say thank you? A big thank you to you, because you keep it out there. You keep it out there for me, for the rest of our family that are still alive, and I want to thank you very much. And I would like to say, even though the police back in their day, the olden day police, were stupid, as far as I'm concerned, and they've got a lot to answer for, the police today, and you mentioned their names, I have more than great admiration for what they did and for how they brought it forward for us. But it's not over. No.
Mate, they brought it good. They brought it right to the door of the court. And they did a fantastic job. So listen, thank you again, John. So listen, somebody out there has the information. Somebody else may have spoken to Jeffrey Charles Hunt, Because he has a knack of confessing about this. He's full of guilt, maybe still to this day. I'm not talking to anybody these days, though. But if you know something from the past, maybe you've held it back because you didn't want to say anything until mum died or some other change. But now's the time while the family is still there and something can be done. So if you know anything, Crime Stoppers, 1-800-333-000 or your local police station, or you can tell us, tell somebody. Don't keep quiet. You can see what this does to families. If you've got information that can help, think of your own family before you withhold it any longer. Thanks for listening to Adam Shand at Large. Back again next week with a new story.